And right now, we want to take a shot of the stage here at Bailey Hall in Broward County. And as you can see, the two candidates who were invited to take part in this debate right now are not stepping up on the stage. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an extremely peculiar situation right now.
A weird standoff last night in a debate between Florida Governor Rick Scott and his challenger, Charlie Crist, over a fan Crist wanted on stage. We'll have more on that later in the show. But first, LAUSD Superintendent John Dacey resigned this morning. Former Superintendent Ray Cortinas is stepping in until the school board finds a permanent replacement. For the past 3.5 years, Dacey's been a divisive leader. He oversaw significant improvements in student test scores, but he also alienated teachers and botched 2 big technology projects. Steve Zimmer is a member of the school board, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, just a year ago, you said you and most of the board wanted Dacey to stay. What changed?
Well, I think a year ago, there was still a tremendous amount of work to be done on a policy level to bring the types of changes to LA Unified that would set us on the trajectory of transforming outcomes for all kids. This year, we're in a situation where we have to begin to implement these changes. And implementation takes a different kind of leadership than actually getting the changes through. And we've had a lot of very, very deep conversations about what it will take to build the type of collaboration we need to actually make change real in every school community.
So you're saying you couldn't collaborate with John Dacey?
I'm saying that a lot of the circumstances of the moment combined to both Superintendent Dacey and the board to reach this decision together. It was an excruciatingly difficult decision. The outcome changes are very important and very real. There's also been a lot of pain that has come with the changes that we've made. And to do the type of healing and unifying that's needed to move us forward, we both parties, both the superintendent and the board together, decided to make this change at this moment.
And is it fair to say, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about this, but is it fair to say that it was the technology problems with the iPads and with this MISIS computerized scheduling fiasco, that it was those things that really put this over the edge and made it time for Dacey to step down?
I wouldn't attribute it to a single factor. I think that the fact that we have not reached our aspirations yet with the Common Core Technology Project is very painful for everyone. We have a really, really critical digital divide in our community. We intended to try and eradicate that, and the effort has not been successful. That's been very painful. The MISIS crisis in our schools has caused a lot of disruption and a lot of struggle, both for kids, their teachers, and their counselors. Of course, we would rather have that decision not been made. But it's not a single factor that's led to this moment. It's a combination of a lot of different things that are going on that led us to believe that in order to continue the positive trajectory for student outcomes, we needed to make this decision.
What is his biggest achievement, do you think?
Well, I think without a doubt, the increase in graduation rates is why we are here. It's why we're here as a Board of Education. It's why we bring the superintendent. And the many things that he has laser focused on to improve instruction and to kind of galvanize us in that direction are without a doubt his best achievement. I would also say that he has been an outstanding spokesperson about the conditions facing over 80% of our kids. And when the conditions of poverty in Boyle Heights become part of the dinner conversation in Brentwood, that's very important to creating larger changes in our city.
Well, has that in fact happened, do you think? Or are parents in Brentwood, and I use Brentwood symbolically, but more well-off parents, are they saying, forget it, I can't be part of this system that is not succeeding. I'm going to put my kids either into private school or into charter schools?
Well, I mean, there's a long conversation that we could have about choice and about what choice means in all parts of LAUSD. But I think that the point I was trying to make is that I think that there's been a collective consciousness that's been raised about how conditions for teaching and learning affect student achievement. And whether or not the family, whatever a family in Brentwood or anywhere else, decides to send their child to school, what we care about is, do you care about the schools that all children attend? And I think that there's been a collective raising of these issues that I think is a net positive for both LA Unified and our entire LA community.
Well, what about the issue that he was facing some stiff opposition from the union, for one, and from some members of the school board who didn't want to see some of his policies put through that he thought would help students, and that would be school choice, for one, and that politics really got in the way in many instances of good decision making.
I wouldn't call it politics, and I wouldn't say I think the decisions that we've made collectively in terms of our policies have absolutely put kids first. And I think that there's been a lot of unity, and I think we did a lot of this as a team. I do think that we have not been careful enough about how we speak about an issue versus, like, for example, seniority versus our teachers themselves. And the morale amongst the individuals who are giving their lives to change outcomes for kids, the morale is very low. And we can't really achieve change together if we are not showing teachers the respect and dignity that they deserve, and actually ensuring that they feel that we believe in them, and we believe that they can do, and we believe that they can change outcomes. That's been a part of the messaging and framing that we haven't been careful enough with, and we need to enter into a time where we're much more intentional about ensuring that folks think that we believe in them.
Steve Zimmer, member of the LAUSD School Board, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mel.
Judith Perez is president of Associated Administrators of Los Angeles. That's a union representing principals and their assistants, and she's on the line now. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
Now, you have said you are happy to see John Dacey go. Why?
I think he's a polarizing figure for public education, not only in Los Angeles, but nationally. We, as another union, have worked very hard to make sure that the needs of our members are met. We represent principals, assistant principals, and other administrators. And to the extent that the superintendent represents the district, he sits at the other side of the table. The morale of our members has been the worst ever during his tenure. And I said earlier, he's a polarizing figure. He tends to pit himself against certain employees, particularly teachers, and I do not believe that is a benefit to students or any of us within the city. So to that extent, I feel this is a timely move.
Okay, let me just read a little bit from his resignation letter where he says that after 3.5 years, the youth have a significantly better education today than they did before. And he cites graduation rates, achievement rates in math and English, language arts, reclassification rates, AP course takers, safety suspension, attendance, so many others clearly point to a better life for students in our care, is what he wrote in his letter, basically saying that the district is a lot better off now. Sure, maybe he ruffled a few feathers at the schools and at the union, but for the students, things are better now than they were 4 years ago.
And I believe that in his role as superintendent, he is taking credit for the work of teachers and school site administrators who on a day-to-day basis do the work to ensure that students improve with graduation rates improve and so forth. I do believe, in my opinion, it is disingenuous of him to take full credit for all of that. We were on an improvement trajectory in this district for at least 10 years, and I believe that credit where credit is due, and that's with the students themselves and the school site personnel who work hard every day to help them improve.
Okay, so Raymond Cortinas is stepping in, at least temporarily. He's 82 years old. He's been in this position before. Are you happy to have him back, at least temporarily?
We had a very good working relationship with Mr. Cortinas when he was superintendent before Dr. Daisy arrived on the scene, and I anticipate we will continue that positive working relationship.
Judith Perez, President of Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a step back and look at some of the big picture questions Daisy's ouster raises about the stability of the LAUSD. Charles Taylor Kirchner is a professor emeritus at Claremont Graduate University. He's the author of Learning from LA, Institutional Change in American Public Education. And he writes the blog On California for Education Week. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Now, you have said that John Daisy was really dealt a bad hand from the start. How so?
Two ways. One was fiscal. I mean, it's very, very difficult to take over a school district anywhere in the country when there's no money. And indeed, over the last 40 years, almost every big reform plan that the district's tried to involve itself in has been hobbled by a lack of money. But the bigger question, an issue in my hand, is the fact that the district's been deadlocked politically. There's a form of fairly toxic trench warfare that's taken place both in the community and on the school board. And when you're superintendent and you're having to count votes every time you go into a school board meeting, that's a tough go.
Is this a win for the union?
Oh, is it a win for the union? The bad thing about all of this is, through all of this fighting, and going back 15 years or so, there haven't been big winners. I mean, if you ask a teacher in Los Angeles now, is their job better than it was 5 or 6 years ago, you'll get almost a resounding vote saying it isn't. So was it a win for the union in the sense that the union leadership was not friendly to John Daisy? Yes, in that sense. But is it an elemental win for the union? No.
Well, you could argue that one of the major reasons why teachers are unhappy now are financial reasons, fiscal reasons, and that this was part of the national fiscal crisis that our country has gone through, the fact that the budgets were slashed for public education, and that trickled down into the classroom, obviously.
Indeed, that's the case. But one of the things that's starting to happen in California is that we've got a bit of a new fiscal reality in two ways. One, California's recovering relatively nicely. We've got a new tax measure that's putting money into the school. And the big thing that's happening in the state is this local control financing that gives the individual school districts a lot more say in how they spend the money that they get. So all this is sort of increasing good news as we go on. The local control financing formula kicks in gradually over a period of years, and right now teachers are both mentally and in terms of their contract in sort of a catch-up phase. They'd like to get a little bit back of what they gave up during the recession.
A lot of people have wondered. You know, we see superintendents come and go. They don't last very long, 3 years, maybe 4 years, 2 years in some cases, that it's just impossible to run this district. It's too big. There are too many political factions, and it's an impossible job for anyone.
You can make that case. And indeed, I raised it in a piece I wrote recently. One of the options that the district has faced for a number of years, and the wise people go over to that brink and look over and pull back from it, is whether it's time to to make the district smaller and break it up into smaller pieces that are would be more easily governed. But that doesn't mean any of the underlying problems go away. They've still got the same number of children. They have the same sort of neighborhoods and conditions in which they live. But it might be time to think about a smaller set of school districts. On the other hand, it might be time to revise the notion some sort of a large civic coalition. We had a very vibrant civic coalition in the 1990s. It was called LEARN, and the Annenberg people put some money into it under the name of LAMP, that held a number of important ideas together for at least a decade, and these ideas are all still around. The idea that the district needs to be recentralized, the idea that we need to increase parent engagement, the idea that we need to create some universal high standards for kids rather than having standards for rich kids that are different than standards for poor kids, and the idea that we need to have assessments that are helpful and transparent. So these are all ideas that haven't been toxic, that the city has come to grips with before and built around. It could do that again.
L.A. is not the only district that is going through some pretty big questions when it comes to public education surrounding two issues. One, school choice, whether or not parents and students should have a choice in which schools they attend. And the other being teacher tenure and whether or not the union should guarantee that teachers stay in the classroom, whether or not they're qualified to be there. How do you think LAUSD's battles with John Dacey and his attempts to try to change those, how do you think that's emblematic of what's going on nationwide?
It's a case in point. Los Angeles has had a fairly interesting rolling experiment that nobody's fully captured in with the idea of different kinds of choice. We've got choice about where students go to school. We've also got a choice program in who runs schools. Los Angeles has had a lot of variety in how it's approached this. It has more charter schools in its catchment area than any other school district in the United States. And inside the school district, it's got a bunch of what it calls pilot schools that are essentially in-district charter schools where the people inside the schools themselves get a lot of choice about how they run their schools. This is a very interesting rolling experiment, and it's gone on for 4 or 5 or 6 superintendencies. So my guess is that it'll continue. It'll get tweaked as it goes along.
All right. Charles Taylor Kirshner, professor emeritus at Claremont Graduate University, and he writes a blog called On California for Education Week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Was it time for John Dacey to go, or has high superintendent turnover been bad for the school district? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we'll play your voicemails at the end of the show. Coming up, why Marvel is getting into the book business. They hope to attract more girls to their empire. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the Marvel juggernaut continues to take over the world. We've got Marvel movies, TV show, comics, cartoons, and now young adult books. The company announced this week that it would put out a series of YA novels featuring Black Widow.
Before I worked for S.H.I.E.L.D., I made a name for myself. I have a very specific skill set.
Black Widow is played by Scarlett Johansson in the Avengers and Iron Man movies, and young adult lit could play a big role in Marvel's earnings in the future. Alex Abad-Santos writes about pop culture for Vox.com. Welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to have you. Okay, so she's a character in these comic books and in the movies, and now they're going to have a whole book franchise around her?
Yeah. At New York Comic Con this past weekend, Marvel announced that the author of Beautiful Creatures, which is a very successful YA book, was going to be writing the Black Widow novel. I think it's only one novel right now. Depending on how it goes, Marvel could probably extend that. But this is their first real, sign that it's investing into young adult literature.
Because it hopes to get a whole bunch of money from that, I assume?
Yeah. Well, there's tons of money. When you look at all the book sales, you have that. I think the Beautiful Creatures series that Margaret Stoll did something like 3.5 million copies of it being sold. And then when you translate that into movies, you have stuff like The Hunger Games and Twilight, which make just piles and piles of money. And I don't think Marvel has tapped into that yet.
Okay, so is it noteworthy that this first book for Marvel, or the first book that they want to make into a juggernaut, has a female hero?
I think so. I think when you look at YA, you see that girls read more than boys, and girls generally have better attitudes to reading than boys do. And then when you extrapolate that into adults, you see that women read more than men. And so Marvel has always had this trouble of trying to grow its market, which is just primarily male readers. And by going into YA, they're tapping into that female readership. And I think it's a pretty good move for them.
And this isn't going to be a comic or a graphic novel, right? It's going to be a straight-up novel?
There weren't any panels being shown at Comic-Con. And who knows, there might be a couple interspersed into the novel. But it looks like it's just going to be primarily just text.
Hmm. Well, I wonder why they decided to do that, because graphic novels are popular with girls.
They do have graphic novels, and they do have comic books that are now, I think they're slowly tapping into female readership with their comic books. Mm-hmm. And comic books like Ms. Marvel, which follows a teenage girl who's Muslim and is just trying to find her way in the world. And that's one of their biggest sellers. So I think they're trying to capitalize on that.
Well, that's interesting. Tell us more about Ms. Marvel.
I think this is one of the reasons that Marvel wants to get into YA, is that this growing success of Ms. Marvel. Her name is Kamala Khan. She's a Pakistani-American teenage girl, and it's one of the biggest sellers for Marvel. It just went into its seventh reprint, which for a comic is kind of unheard of. I think that's just a handful of comic books that do that. And so you have this teenage protagonist that's wildly popular, and it's not just teenage girls who are reading it. It's everyone reading it. I think seeing that Ms. Marvel's success gave Marvel the incentive to go into YA and really actually explore a story of a young adult Black Widow being a hot mess.
So in terms of the business, was this a big shocker then? Were people like, oh my gosh, what is Marvel doing and how is it going to change the industry?
It wasn't that much of a shock, because it's just a savvy business move considering all the money that can be made there.
Yeah.
And all the things that Marvel wants to do with its female readership. It just makes total sense. But I think just seeing that Black Widow name attached to a YA novel, and she's probably one of the most high-profile heroes right now because of the Avengers movies, attached to a YA novel, people really were just juiced and amped for it.
Well, it doesn't hurt that she's played by Scarlett Johansson.
It does not hurt. Yes, you are completely right there.
Alex Abad Santos writes about pop culture for Vox.com. Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up on the program, the Sklar brothers are here. The Sklar brothers are here, yes, to talk World Series and a series of missteps in the NFL. Sports after a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's talk some sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Kansas City headed to the World Series for the first time since 1985. The team completed its sweep of the Orioles last night with a 2-1 win.
Router to third, fair ball. Moustakas across. 29 years of frustration has ended. The Royals are going to the World Series.
Jason and Randy Sklar, also known as the Sklar Brothers, are here. Hi, you guys.
We're great. Did you hear when he got the ball that you heard like a little a faint? It sounded like booing. Yeah. They weren't booing. They were saying Moustakas, which is an interesting. He's an interesting guy because he's kind of been a hero in this postseason for them. And in the middle of the season, he was sent down
to the minors
because he just wasn't playing well. And here's this guy comes back up and now has just, I mean, he's been unbelievable at third base, like made incredible plays in the field, hit some really significant home runs. And the Royals have won 8 games in a row. They won the play-in game, which we talked about, the wild card game.
They were losing by four runs in the eighth inning. So if they would have lost that game, these playoffs would be different. And from that game, they have not lost.
They swept the powerful Angels, which had the best record in baseball and had the best player in the American League in Mike Trout and, of course, Albert Pujols. They swept them. Then they play the Baltimore Orioles, who, again, had a magical year, won the American League East.
Did they sweep the Tigers? They beat the Tigers. I think they swept the Tigers. So the Orioles were on a roll, and then they ran
They didn't sweep the Tigers.
But they did beat the Tigers very handily, and then the Kansas City Royals took them. They were the buzzsaw.
Are you giving them more series? I think they only had 2 series.
Well, so they 29 years. That's a long time.
It's been 29 years, right? 1985 since they've been in the World Series, where they beat the Cardinals,
our team, and we remember that. We were kids watching that World Series, and there was a famous call during that series in Game 6. Cardinals were up 3 games to 2, and in the late innings, Todd Worrell, who's the pitcher for the Cardinals, came over to cover on a
ground
ball
to the
first baseman, and his foot was on the bag when he caught the ball, and then he swept the leg back again to try and get a second time. The umpire missed it. Don Dankinger, famous play. He missed the call, called him safe. The Royals won, and then they went on to win Game 7 in Kansas City, like 13-0. It was a blowout, and they won the World Series, first time in a while. But that was the last time they won, and it's what's amazing is this year, instant replay has been instituted. So if that play were to happen this year, he would have been out. He would have been out, and the Cardinals probably would have won.
And we're not still bitter, Matt.
We're not bitter.
We're not still bitter. Okay, Jason, you are wearing your St. Louis Cardinals hat.
I'm wearing it.
In the studio.
We went to the game. Actually, Randy and I and a couple friends drove up to the game in San Francisco.
On Tuesday of this past week.
And it was such an amazing atmosphere. First of all, that ballpark is incredible. And it's amazing to go see a playoff game. And at this time, it feels like San Francisco is on its way.
Tonight's the game.
They're up 3-1. They've got Madison Bumgarner, who has been the best pitcher in the postseason. The guy's been incredible, and he made the Cardinals look silly in Game 1.
They lost 3-0.
The guy's just an incredible left-handed pitcher. Cardinals have a lot of left-handed batters, and he throws from such a weird angle, almost behind the left-handed batters. It's hard, if you're a lefty, to pick up what pitch he's throwing. He's throwing it from almost behind you. So made a lot of guys look silly. They're playing in San Francisco. We were up there for the game. The atmosphere is beyond electric.
I mean, the crowd is crazy. The ballpark is a weird shape. The wind is swirling. Steve Perry is lip syncing his own songs up in the stands.
My favorite is Steve Perry was there and they were playing Don't Stop Believing, and he's lip syncing and he's literally one section.
And he messed up the words.
He messed up his own words. You got to know the words to your own darn song there, Steve Perry.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that crazy?
And he was on the Jumbotron.
Jumbotron waving a towel around him. He's a huge San Francisco fan. I mean, that's what the song is.
Look, we talked to a lot of Dodgers fans. The Dodgers, they don't love the Cardinals right now because the Cardinals knocked them out.
But they hate the San Francisco Giants. Hate
this
them.
This is how much they hate the Giants. There are Dodgers fans, a lot of L.A. Dodgers fans rooting for the Cardinals to beat the Giants.
So the enemy of my enemy is my friend
That's the way it goes. And so it looks like, I mean, unless there's a miraculous comeback. Now, if the Cardinals can win this game by somehow, some stretch of the imagination, the series does shift back to St. Louis for Games 6 and 7. So you've got home games playing there. San Francisco's the type of team, they're like Dracula. You just can't kill them. You can't kill them. Even a stake in the heart, I feel like, would not even kill this team. They're just unbelievable. Even when they're down, they come back. In the last 2 games, they've come back, and they find a way to win.
And if San Francisco does, in fact, go on to the World Series, this will be 2 wild card teams making it into the World Series. So 2 teams that didn't win their divisions.
Mm-hmm. But they can't, and exactly, had to win that play-in game. And so what's amazing about that is Bud Selig, the commissioner, who this was his last year this year, he really designed adding that extra wild card team and adding that extra sort of one game playoff between the two wild cards to see who plays the best team, that was like one of the most genius things he could have ever done. And so to see both of those teams playing, that basically says to any team out there, all you have to do is make it in the playoffs. Because the Royals were a good team, okay?
Yeah.
They played well, but then they kind of faltered a little bit, and they were a wild card team. But now they've swept everybody. They've won 8 games in a row. Ned Yost, their manager. Okay, he's a first-time playoff manager, and this is the first time in history a first-time playoff manager has won 8 games in a row.
Okay, Sklar brothers,
yes.
Randy and Jason Sklar, let's move on to basketball mm-hmm. and talk about Steve Nash. Talk about a vampire.
The Lakers.
40 years old.
Oldest
right?
player in the league. He's the oldest player in the league at 40 years old.
And he hurt himself recently.
As a point guard.
Not on the court.
No, he hurt himself apparently. And this
here's
is
the
vague.
Report. This is what we got so far. Carrying bags.
And I
for himself.
Well, first thing,
or carrying someone else's baggage.
Well, first of all, we could have been emotional baggage.
We don't know.
And again, it's like that can sometimes hurt you if you're thinking about it too much. But I imagine him like at Trader Joe's, just outside the parking lot. It's a crazy parking lot, you know, Trader Joe's. And someone might have been walking. He's like, here, let me get that for you, because he's that type of guy.
And then boom.
Or even at LAX or something.
He was injured a lot last year. He only played in 15 games. He once was a great, great point guard. And I think the Lakers were hoping to get some stability with him, a player like him, leadership on the floor. He really didn't deliver last year. He was injured for most of the year, and now he's out again.
I mean, this is – look, the Lakers picked up Jeremy Lin Sanity, who mm-hmm. From Houston. The Houston Rockets. And so I think he's just going to be step in and take over sort of where Steve Nash – just take over the role of being the point guard, and he can do it.
It's not a huge loss for Lakers. It's not like Kevin Durant, who is now out for the Oklahoma City Thunder. That's a way bigger loss for that
team. And what happened to him?
He broke his foot, broke the fifth metatarsal in his foot. It's called a Jones break. And the reason I know it is that I did it to my own foot twice in 1 year.
While playing basketball, right?
While playing basketball. It's basically like you can roll your ankle playing basketball. Yeah. You basically roll over that part of your foot. Ugh. And it's a break. And the reason why it's a difficult break is that's an area of your foot, my doctor explained to me, that doesn't get a lot of blood flow. Uh-huh. So the bone doesn't grow that quickly. I had to do this weird experimental magnetic bone growth stimulation thing. I'm sure they have like the most state-of-the-art stuff.
They're just putting a different foot on him.
They might literally
they could do that.
Foot transplant. But point
either
is
way, they're going to be without him for at least 8 weeks, maybe 12
weeks.
Which
bodes well for the Clippers, because you looked at Oklahoma City and you said, okay, this team, now that the Heat are broken up, and who knows how LeBron's going to do in Cleveland. Obviously, he's got in the East. But it looked like Oklahoma City was the team to beat from the West, and they probably make it back pretty easily. They have all their pieces intact. Now he's got a broken foot. You don't know. I mean, look, it's a long season, and he can always come back. If Russell Westbrook, a L.A. native, can actually play well at point guard, and he does play better than when Kevin Durant's off the court. But still, I think this bodes well for the Clippers, who might be able to make an early surge.
Okay, and the preseason coming to a close.
Yes.
Jason?
Preseason in basketball. For all people who think that the regular season doesn't mean very much in the NBA, the preseason means even less. And to indicate that, the coach of the Spurs, Greg Popovich, the world champion Spurs, isn't even making the trip to go to a game. Like, you know it's bad when they leave a player off the roster. When the coach isn't even going, that tells you how insignificant.
But here's what's interesting. There is a female assistant coach on
the Spurs.
San Antonio Spurs. They just hired. And let's say the guy who's the acting head coach or one or two of those guys gets thrown out of the game for whatever reason. We could see she's down on the bench, just moved closer to the head coaching. I mean, how brilliant would it be to see a woman coaching
an NBA team
full of men? That to me would be
as
a father of daughters,
amazing.
It'd be an amazing moment.
And why hasn't it happened already?
It should happen.
Okay. Speaking of no female coaches, let's talk about football.
Yeah.
And
it is amazing when you hear, you know, women calling college football and whatnot, because there's this like, well, you never played. There's this sort of attitude about
female announcers in college football.
But
I think we're a long way away from seeing a female head coach in the NFL.
Okay. Dallas Cowboys, surprising success story there.
Yeah, they always
seem 5-1.
5-1 now. They always seem to find a way to be 8-8. That's our joke, is that they'll find a way to get to 8-8. And barely miss the playoffs or make one playoff game.
But they've had some key, significant wins. They beat the world champion Seattle Seahawks.
In Seattle, which is almost an impossible place to win. So they won that game. But the best thing is, like, after the game, their backup running back, Joseph Randall, was caught shoplifting.
Really?
Shoplifting on Monday. So he celebrated the big win in Seattle
yes.
by picking up a tester bottle of cologne mm-hmm. and a 2-pack of underwear. two pack of polo underwear and a tester bottle. I mean, the tester bottle, I get it. It's sort of like, hey,
was he really shoplifting or did you just forget to pay?
Really shoplifting and was caught outside and said I should have kept walking to my car.
That was
if
his
I would have known that I was caught shoplifting, I would have kept walking to my car. I'm like, how does that?
That doesn't go well for a running back as far as elusivity. Like, that's a guy you want to be able to elude.
If the 69-year-old security guard is stopping you, you've got to work on your moves a little bit more. But I mean,
I imagine he can
four year $2.5 million contract. He should be able to pay for.
Pair of so what's going to happen to him?
He is going to be fined by the team up to $20,000 to $30,000, I believe. But he will be allowed to play in the next game. And it's funny the state of where the NFL is.
Like, we think about it, and we're like, this is more of just a silly story. Like, at least he wasn't doing any real damage. Like, that's how bad the NFL is.
Yeah, like, he wasn't headbutting a toddler. No. So he's just stealing some tester cologne.
Okay. Another scandal is the Redskins, the Washington Redskins. And now it looks like, can they even play in Minnesota? Because there's some sort of dust up there in terms of offending people
this
at the University
feels
of Minnesota.
Like, yeah, it feels like, I don't know if you've been watching Boardwalk Empire, but everybody's trying, you know, trying to put the squeeze on Al Capone. Like, let's get to his money and put the squeeze on him. And so I feel like, you know,
everybody is trying to find a way to get the Redskins to relent.
To stop using the name. I mean, I really feel like it's, you know, they feel like it's very offensive to Native Americans, and enough is enough. And sort of this whole idea of like, well, it's been the Redskins all this time. Well, maybe it's been wrong the whole time as well. And why can't you just call yourself?
There was a long period where the Washington basketball team was the Washington Bullets. And people thought, well, that's not a great name for
especially since Washington, D.C. for years was the murder capital of
So they changed their name to the Washington Wizards, and people didn't stop coming to the games. People kept coming and following and supporting the team. The Wizards are actually a great team this
year. They are a great team this year. So it's there are announcers, Phil Simms, who's a national announcer for the NFL and for Fox. He won't call them the Redskins. He just calls them the team from Washington. So
but they're just refusing to back down.
Dan Snyder, who's the owner of the Redskins, and typically not considered to be a great owner. I mean, the team is not doing that well, and he sort of spends money in a weird way, and is not considered a shrewd and great. He's not Bob Kraft, who is the owner of the
Patriots
in New England Patriots, who's considered to be a good owner. He's kind of makes a lot of mistakes, and he's really defending it. And it's like, really, you're going to stay on board with
digging
this thing?
Heels in right now?
Yeah, you kind of want to say to the guy, you're on the wrong side of the argument. You're going. It's like,
I personally think the tide is going to sway so much that he won't have a choice and they're going to have to change
them. And it just eventually, that's just the way people are going to go. And kudos to everybody. I mean, look, you can make these changes. Even in the rough and tumble world of sports, we can be a little progressive.
Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers, and you can check out their stand-up special. It's called What Are We Talking About? On Netflix and on iTunes. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Got a little Royals there for you, a little Lord in honor of the Kansas City Royals. Warren Olney is here now to tell us what's up at 1 o'clock.
We are going to be talking about the Army now being withdrawn, of course, from Afghanistan and Iraq. What are they going to do with no boots on the ground in some of these other places? They are looking for a mission, and it's a very interesting search that they are undertaking. Are they going to be winning wars in the future? Are they going to be preventing wars in the future? What about the number of contractors who now, in some cases, outnumber the number of soldiers on the ground? It was the contractors that actually trained the Iraqi troops that turned and ran and left behind all of that equipment. A lot of interesting things to be said about the Army, and we've got some very interesting people to talk about.
Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock in just 15 minutes from now. Warren Olney, and To the Point, thank you.
I'll be there.
And coming up on this program, the most bizarre beginning to a political debate, perhaps ever. We'll tell you what happened last night in Florida next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now a story about a man and his number one fan.
We have Governor Charlie Crist, Florida Governor Rick Scott. Our incumbent governor and the Republican candidate for governor is also in the building. Governor Rick Scott, we have been told that Governor Scott will not be participating in this debate. Now, let me explain what this is all about. Governor Crist has asked to have a fan, a small fan, placed underneath his podium. The rules of the debate that I was shown by the Scott campaign say that there should be no fan. Somehow there is a fan there, and for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, I am being told that Governor Scott will not join us for this debate.
Moderator Elliot Rodriguez of CBS Miami at last night's Florida gubernatorial debate between Republican Governor Rick Scott and his opponent, former governor and Democrat Charlie Crist. Molly Ball, Atlantic Magazine's intrepid political reporter, has the story of the fan and what followed. She's here with us now. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, that just sounds insane and crazy. How did it look as it was happening?
It looked insane and crazy. I mean, for six whole minutes, if you were watching this debate live, the moderators were sort of talking about themselves. What do we do? What do we do? And in what I think is a sort of a political masterstroke by Charlie Crist, he strode onto that stage, he took his place at the podium, and he sort of looked out at the crowd and smiled and said, let's talk about the issues. Why won't Governor Scott debate me on the issues? It's still unclear who was in the right on the technicality. But, you know, and the odd thing also is that, as you mentioned, the fan has been a fixture of Charlie Crist's political career for a long time. And a lot of people have made fun of him for it, that he takes it everywhere, that, you know, it makes him look sort of like a prima donna who always has to make sure that no one sees him sweat. But he was the one who seemed to have won this because of the fan, because of his demand for a fan. And in this strange turn of events, it made Rick Scott look like the one who was being unreasonable, that he wouldn't just come on the stage and have the debate.
Right. And so you have the debate moderators not really sure how to deal with the situation.
So the rules that the Scott campaign just showed us, that says that no electronics can be used,
including
fans.
Are we really going to debate about a fan? Or are we going to talk about education and the environment and the future of our state? I mean, really.
So, yeah, he did look like he was rising above it, cool and collected, not breaking a sweat,
so to speak.
Thanks
cool
to the
as
fan.
A cucumber. Yeah, no spin here.
Right. And you talk about the fact that he has this history with the fan. For many, many years, he's brought the fan with him, even to trips to Europe. And this is why? Because he sweats a lot?
Well, that's apparently the rationale. You know, I spoke to a longtime Florida political player who has known Charlie Crist for more than two decades, and said that at least since he ran for education commissioner, his first statewide office in 2000, so 14 years ago, Charlie Crist had that fan with him and demanded it be with him everywhere he went. When he was governor, he was famous for having his advance team go into every room and set up the fan before he would walk in. You know, there's a clip on YouTube from 2010 when he was doing a TV interview, and you could hear this weird buzzing noise under him speaking, and the anchor then revealed that it was because he had to have that fan with him. Amazingly enough, almost this same circumstance happened in 2006, almost a decade ago. He's the attorney general. He's running for governor for the first time in a Republican primary. And he goes on stage for the debate. He has a fan. His opponent doesn't have a fan. And his opponent says to the moderator, this isn't fair. I'm not going to do this unless I get a fan, too. And the debate was delayed until they could find a second fan. So a real sense of deja vu for longtime watchers of Charlie Crist in Florida politics.
So this is Charlie Crist's secret weapon. And is that why Rick Scott wanted to have it removed? Like, this is the thing that's going to put him over in the debate?
Well, that was sort of my theory in the tongue-in-cheek piece that I wrote today, is why is this fan such a fixation? And I think for both his fans and his detractors alike. It really symbolizes something about Crist. And, you know, I wrote this piece almost as if the fan was a character, was a friend, was a sort of security blanket
like
for
a comfort
Charlie
animal.
Because he seems so dependent on it in a way that is sort of ridiculous. But at the same time, the fan came to his rescue, right? The fan provided this strange moment that has become such a matter of great interest out of what would otherwise be a sort of parochial, you know, state election. Because it was just so weird, just so Florida, I guess you could say. And so it's almost as if Charlie's friend that he was so loyal to for so many years has come back in and done him a solid.
All right. So Rick Scott eventually makes an appearance and decides to actually debate Charlie Crist after all with the fan whirring. And how did the debate go after that?
Well, you know, it was quite a good debate. I mean, both of these candidates have been governors, so they both know the issues very well. It's a very hard-fought election, tens of millions of dollars being spent on both sides. Florida, obviously, is a very closely contested state. It was the closest state in the 2012 presidential election, and Rick Scott won it by a very, very close margin in 2010. And so there's a lot of important stuff going on here, a really important debate being held about jobs. I think, you know, the headline out of this debate, had it not been for what some are calling the fandal, would have been about, you know, just how acrimonious it was and the competing claims and the animosity between the two of them. You know, at one point they were asked to compliment each other and Crist said, well, I do give Governor Scott credit for what he's done with the response to Ebola. And Governor Scott said, well, that was very nice of you to say. And that was it. He didn't have a further compliment for Charlie Crist. So it's clear there's no love lost between these guys. But then there was so much, you know, so now we can have this conversation in real time, in public. And there was so much social media chatter about the fan that the debate moderators went back to it before the debate was over and asked the candidates about it. And Scott gave a pretty much incoherent response and still hasn't really accounted for what he was thinking. And Charlie Crist said, well, what's wrong with being comfortable?
Yeah. So, and I guess he's being pretty much, Governor Scott's being excoriated this today for this decision. Some people saying that his campaign manager should be fired for that advice to make a big deal out of this fan. And this is a race that is neck and neck, according to the poll. So could this be the thing that puts Charlie Crist into the governor's mansion again?
Well, look, obviously this is a trivial issue. Obviously this is not a matter of substance. I'm sure you can make an argument that it tells you something profound about the character of both candidates. But a lot of Republicans really do feel like this is political malpractice on the part of Scott and his team because it makes him look so bad. And that in an election that could hinge on a few votes, the votes of a lot of people who maybe haven't been paying attention up to this time, and this just reminds them of something that maybe bugs them about Governor Scott, who's not very popular in the state, sure, it could make a difference.
And tell us just a little bit about Charlie Crist's latest reinvention, because he was a Republican, then he was an independent, he quit the governorship to run for Senate, he is now a Democrat, he's embraced President Obama, even though President Obama is pretty unpopular, I think, in Florida these days. And so how is he reinventing himself yet again in this race?
Charlie Crist is just a great political story, and I wrote a long profile of him back in March, which is part of the reason I was watching the debate and part of the reason that I knew the history of the fan friendship. But, you know, as you said, he was a popular governor of Florida, elected in 2006 as a Republican. You can find clips of him calling himself a conservative Republican, but he really was always a moderate. There were a lot of people in the right wing of the Republican Party who couldn't stand him because they didn't think he was true to conservative values. He did a lot of things on education and the environment. And then instead of running for re-election in 2010, he ran for the U.S. Senate. And we all remember that 2010 was the year of the Tea Party. In that primary, Crist had the support of the Republican establishment, but a little-known state lawmaker named Marco Rubio came along, made the case that Crist was not a conservative. And Crist, seeing that he was way down in this primary, left the Republican Party, became an independent, lost that election, was out of office, And then started inching toward the Democratic Party. So, you know, the polls show this race to be very, very close. I think it really could go either way. Scott is unpopular, but Crist is very unpopular, too. There's been a lot of negative ads against him, and people are very suspicious of this flip-flop that he's done. He's changed his positions on a lot of issues. There's a view of him as someone who will sort of say anything to be liked, say anything to get elected. And so these are two men that the electorate is not particularly a fan of, you might say.
Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic magazine and really number one fan of Charlie Crist fan. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you, Madeline.
I'm a fan of Joli Myers.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over the cooling agent that's coming at my head right now. Another unpopular politician, LAUSD Superintendent John Dacey. He's out. He resigned earlier today. We wanted to know what you thought about the change. On Facebook, our listeners basically rejoiced. Rebecca Turkos says, "Ding dong, the witch is dead." I imagine her singing that at home right now along with me. And Richard Angel says, "Good riddance. Should have been gone a long, long time ago." Catherine called in with a question.
I am wondering why, in a discussion that you just had about DC and people's feelings about it, why someone from the teachers' union wasn't included in the discussion.
So there was a little bit of criticism of the teachers' union by some of our guests today. While we did reach out to the head of the teachers' union, Alex Caputo-Pearl originally agreed to come on, but then decided to wait until a press conference at 2 to comment on the situation. The invitation stands, though. You can come on whenever.
I'm sure we'll get him on soon.
I think so. Back on Facebook, Martin Van Buskirk points out that, yeah, Dacey's gone, but he's taking his golden parachute with him. He's getting $60,000 as part of his departure agreement, which ends up being about 2 months' pay, according to his original contract. And Roberto Sanchez says, "Yay, bring on the next guy that no one will like."
So that seems to be just about it for the history of superintendents of LAUSD. Joli Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And if you have anything that you want to say, we welcome it. We'd love to hear from you. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. And you can leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Warren Olney, and To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock, I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.